Chapter 15. We had thought we worked hard the rest of the week, but Sunday has become our most hectic day, because that's the day when every man in the neighborhood comes to call. Last Sunday, we had more than 20 men over for tea, French, British, and American, Quakers, engineers, cavalry, aviators, and civilians. This Sunday, it was luncheon for 12 officers of the American Engineers, roast beef, cauliflower cheese, and chocolate rice pudding. If you think it sounds good, it was. And a British captain who wandered in for some reason or other and turned out to be the DeWitt of DeWitt's biscuits. Our guest book is absolutely killing. You'd never believe the signatures we've collected. Miss Alice Patton, class of 1910, to her sister, Mrs. Gilbert Thomas. November 1917, Grecourt, France. Miss Luce? Kate's muscles moved without conscious direction from her brain. Setting aside the paper she'd been holding, she rose from the bed, saying automatically, "Welcome to Grecourt. We didn't expect you so soon." "My pass came through, so here I am. Is this my bed? Lovely." Emmy had fallen back behind the other woman, trying to make herself as small as possible. A fund, Emmy had told her, a fund set up to pay living expenses and fees. Some of the girls were volunteering to pay their own way, to save the unit expenses, but the money was there, part of the plan. Not charity, Emmy had sworn. Impersonal funding donated by scores of Smith alumni who wanted to do their bit but couldn't go themselves. Money available to anyone. A lie. All a lie. There was no fund. Everyone was paying her own way. Everyone except Kate. "That's your washstand, Miss Luce." Kate felt thoroughly distracted, but the amenities had to be observed. Her voice sounded like it was coming from someone else, calm and normal, when she wanted to scream and howl. "The water tends to freeze overnight, but Marie's son Yves brings us 2 cans of hot water every morning for washing." "Sounds like luxury," said Miss Luce, carpet bags underneath her cot.
"Where can I keep my rabbits?" "In the basse-cour, I would think. That's where we keep our cows. Kate."
Emmy was wringing her hands like Lady Macbeth after a hard night of regicide, wringing and wringing them until Kate wanted to reach out and make her stop, just stop.
"Kate, you should know."
"Yes?" Every muscle in Kate's body tensed. She both wanted to hear what Emmy had to say and was dreading it.
"Liza broke her collarbone,"
Emmy blurted out. "Her collarbone?"
"On the duck walk, although Captain DeWitt says it isn't really a proper duck walk, so maybe that's why."
Liza, duck walk, broken bones. Kate's brain felt like it had been stuffed with wool. Nothing made any sense. "Captain DeWitt?"
"That Englishman we met at the hospital. He just happened to be passing by and gave Miss Luce a lift."
Emmy was backing away, toward the door of the barrack.
"Welcome again, Miss Luce. I'll tell the people in the orangery to ladle out an extra 2 mug of pumpkin soup for you. Unless you can have Liza's. I'm not sure if she'll be up to lunching. I'll just go and check on her, shall I?"
With that, Emmy fled, letting the door bang shut behind her.
"A bit nervy, that one, isn't she?" said Miss Luce, looking after Emmy with interest from her perch on the cot. "Her eyes roll just like a colt I once knew."
"Not usually," said Kate shortly. If Emmy was nervy, it was because she'd been caught out. "It's been a trying day, I gather. Will you excuse me for a moment?" Maybe there was an explanation. Maybe she'd misunderstood. Maybe the accounting was wrong. Either way, Kate needed to know. She needed to hear it from Emmy's own lips. But by the time she found Emmy, diligently scrubbing plates, the engineers had come roaring in, and Kate found herself pressed into service with a ladle, dishing out pumpkin soup into tooth mugs. And then it was a regular melee as everyone rushed about collecting the tooth mugs to be rewashed for the chocolate pudding, setting out platters of cauliflower cheese and roast beef, parrying the banter of the engineers, who were in roaringly high spirits.
All the while, Kate couldn't help looking around the table at her sisters in arms, seeing them as if for the first time, all of them with their own quirks, their capable hands and determined faces, Alice's lacy jabot contrasting with her grimy uniform, Maud ostentatiously waving her engagement ring and speaking loudly of Henry, Liza trussed up in bandages from the waist up, but pink-cheeked and happy as could be, with two engineers to help her manage her cutlery and grab her the best pieces of beef. They all looked so sure of themselves, despite their ragged uniforms that could never be made entirely clean, no matter how Marie scrubbed them. It was an assurance that couldn't be taught, an assurance that came of always having had a cook and housemaid, of knowing that Daddy was a lawyer or a professor or a banker. It sat on them like polish. Kate, wearing the same uniform, no more ragged than the rest, felt nonetheless very small and shabby, as if they could see in her bones she was different, that she wasn't pulling her weight. Her head ached with the din of all those voices, all those strident, confident, honking voices. One of the engineers was asking her about her people, and Kate smiled and responded vaguely. It didn't matter. He mostly wanted to talk about himself anyway, but Kate felt naked, naked and a fraud. Only Julia sat silent, with Dr. Stringfellow on one side and Emmy's British captain on the other. Charity case, Julia had called Kate all those years ago, and Kate had burned at it, at the indignity of it, when she had never accepted a penny from Emmy, when she had been so very, very careful not to ever take anything from Emmy. But now she was what Julia had called her, and worse. Kate looked around the table, wondering what this made her. Not a proper member of the unit, a member of their fellowship, but a sort of paid companion, only there due to the munificence of, what had that loathsome reporter called her? The noble descendant of one of our first families. Emmy's charity case. Would this lunch never end? Finally, the tooth mugs were cleared a second time, sounds of repletion made, napkins dropped. Finally, they could disperse and Kate wouldn't have to keep smiling in a way that made her face hurt. But then the engineers produced, with a great air of triumph, a Victrola.
A dance, cried Nell, hiking up her skirt and hopping out of her chair. Huzzah!
There was no hope for it after that. The tables were pushed aside, the dishes stacked haphazardly to await cleaning later. Marie was miraculously induced to produce coffee, and the luncheon turned into a dance, engineers and smithies galloping around the makeshift dance floor in their rubber boots. Julia, Kate noticed, had disappeared, and she was deeply tempted to do the same, but there were more men than women, and she found herself yanked into first one dance and then another, dancing with a sameness of pink-cheeked, clean-shaven men who all seemed to have a first cousin once removed who was engaged to this or that Smith girl, and say, wasn't it a bully thing they were doing here? Emmy's Brit had been attached by Alice, who was attempting to lead him in a Viennese waltz, swirling and dipping with anxious gaiety. Emmy, meanwhile, had busied herself quietly collecting plates, as if trying to make herself as small as she could. For a moment, their eyes met, and Kate saw pure misery, misery and guilt, before Emmy ducked her head and began stacking plates with renewed vigor. Kate tried to make her way across the room to her. This was absurd. They needed to talk about this. They couldn't just go on being miserable at one another. But she was plucked off by an engineer in want of a dancing partner and neatly suborned into another dance. Waltzing past her, Kate heard Maud's voice, too loud as always. Look at Emmy Van Alden sulking. She shouldn't think she can monopolize DeWitt's biscuits just because she saw him first. Did no one ever teach her to share? Share? Kate wanted to kick Maud's booted legs out from under her. Emmy was the most generous person Kate knew, which was, of course, just the problem. Kate's head ached with thinking about it. She'd pay it back, of course. She wasn't sure how, but she would. But it aided her all the same that all this time, from the very beginning, Emmy had been lying to her. The engineers stayed and stayed. When they finally took their leave, with promises of return engagements, there was Miss Lewes in their room, and Kate could have screamed in frustration. "Emmy," she tried whispering, once Miss Lewes had subsided into snoring slumber on the third cot. But Miss Lewes murmured and turned, and Kate had to retreat beneath the pillow. It wasn't until after breakfast the next day that Kate finally caught Emmy at the chicken coop, draped over the chicken wire, looking mournfully at her poultry. As impossible as it was, the mud seemed even thicker here. Kate sank to the tops of her boots with every step. "Emmy." Emmy looked up at her, her eyes glassy with unshed tears.
"My hens are roosters."
"What?"
"My hens."
Emmy sniffed, scrubbing her nose with a large monogrammed handkerchief.
"Miss Lewes just told me. The reason none of my hens are laying is that they're all roosters. I bought 72 roosters instead of 72 hens. What are we to do with 72 roosters?
Make stew?" It would be so easy just to let herself be drawn back into the day-to-day, to let it all go. But she couldn't. And Kate minded terribly that Emmy was making her feel sorry for her just when she wanted to be angry at her.
"They didn't have big combs, so I thought, but apparently not all French roosters do."
"Yes, things aren't always what they appear, are they?" Emmy bit her lip.
"Kate,
you told me the unit was paying for travel and living expenses." Emmy ducked her head, looking down at her chickens.
"I told you that alumni were donating money."
"And you're an alumna? That's pure sophistry, Emmy, and you know it." There was a world of difference between being bankrolled by an anonymous group of donors and having her expenses paid by someone she knew.
"Why did you assume I couldn't pay? I'm not a pauper, Emmy. My family aren't paupers."
"I know that," said Emmy, a little too quickly.
"We're not poor, Emmy," Kate said fiercely.
But of course they were to Emmy, with her Fifth Avenue mansion and her camp in the Adirondacks and her cottage in Newport that was bigger than most apartment buildings. It didn't mean anything to Emmy that Kate's stepfather, the police officer, could put meat on the table or lace curtains on the windows. Those were inconsequentialities to Emmy, these things that to Kate and her mother had seemed so monumental and miraculous.
"I have a job. I had a job."
Emmy looked at Kate with wide, childlike blue eyes.
"Yes, but why shouldn't my mother pay our way? The cost wasn't anything to her. She spends more than that each week on stamps."
"No, it's not anything to her." The air stank of chicken excrement. Kate's boots were sticky with mud and feathers. Emmy mistook Kate's words for agreement.
"And you know she's always liked you, Kate. She wanted you to be her secretary."
"And I said no." Emmy's forehead wrinkled.
"I never blamed you for that. I know my mother can be a bit..."
"It wasn't because of your mother." Kate rather liked Emmy's mother. There was something about her drive that spoke to Kate. She would have loved to be Mrs. Van Alden's secretary, to travel with her around the world, helping her to write strongly worded letters to the editors of all the major papers.
"I said no because I didn't want to be beholden. I was your friend, Emmy, not your project."
There was a horrible moment where Emmy was silent, the only sounds the clucking of the chickens.
"Wasn't I?" "Of course. You know I would never have got through Smith without you. That's why I wanted you here so badly. I knew I couldn't do this without you. And I knew that you, well, you might not have the money to spare. So I thought that if it were all paid already..."
"You shouldn't have assumed."
"Maybe I shouldn't have, but when I started to tell you about the unit, you looked so skeptical, and I knew you were going to say no."
And there had been that room, that depressing, cabbage-scented room with its paper shades and fraying coverlet, the very picture of poverty. Kate pressed her eyes shut, fighting hard to keep her composure.
"You might have given me the choice."
In a very small voice, Emmy said,
I was afraid if I did, you wouldn't come.
She seemed so small, which was ridiculous since Emmy was a full head taller than Kate, but she did. She seemed so small and so vulnerable. Kate's heart twisted. But then Emmy ruined it all by saying,
"And you did have a choice, didn't you? You had the choice to come or not come. I didn't want the money to be a factor. I knew that you'd be brilliant at it. And the truth is, I didn't know if I could do this without you, Kate. You make everything manageable, even algebra."
But it wasn't a choice, not a true choice. Kate's throat locked. She struggled to find the words to explain, but Emmy was still talking, faster now, as if determined to get it all over with.
"I know it was wrong to lie to you, Kate, I do. It was just, I needed you so badly."
Emmy looked at her appealingly. Kate knew that expression so well. It was Emmy's hapless face, the one that got people to do things for her. She didn't do it on purpose. It was just part of who she was.
"You're not sorry you're here, are you?"
Constantly wet and freezing. Never enough sleep, never enough time. All those different personalities to manage. The challenge of it, never the same from day to day. Always a new obstacle to be surmounted. A new battle to be won. A broken truck to be fixed. A reluctant bureaucrat to bully. It was alarming to realize how much she'd come to love it, this strange life here. One could say many things about it, but it was never dull. Kate never felt, as she had in Boston, that she was wasting her time and her energies. It was maddening and rewarding, and it suited her as nothing else had. "No," said Kate slowly. "I'm not sorry."
"I was so worried at first that you were miserable and I'd done something terrible by bringing you here, but then you seemed so happy. You don't dislike it here, do you?"
Kate's lips felt numb. "No, I don't dislike it." On the contrary, she was terrified of losing it, of Maud finding out and deciding she was hardly a real member of the unit at all. When had she come to love it so?
"Just think what you would have missed if you'd never come."
Emmy leaned forward earnestly.
"And you wouldn't have come if you had had to pay, would you?"
Kate could feel her stomach drop, but she couldn't make herself lie. "No." Emmy's face lit up like 1,000 candles on a Christmas tree. She clapped her hands together, bouncing on the balls of her boots.
"You see? Oh, Kate, surely you must see how much the unit needs you, how much you've done. And you seemed so unhappy at that school in Boston. So it all turned out for the best."
"But that's not..." Kate's throat felt scratchy with frustration and chicken feathers.
"You can't just sweep in and decide you know what's best for me. I'm not one of your settlement house girls, Emmy."
Emmy grabbed Kate's hands in hers, squeezing them affectionately.
"But it was what was best for you, wasn't it? And for the unit. They've made you assistant director. That says something, doesn't it? What does it matter who paid for what? You're here, and that's all that matters."
Kate stood frozen, her hands caught in Emmy's, feeling like she'd never known Emmy, or that Emmy had never known her.
"No, it's not. You've made me into your debtor, your hireling. You've made me beholden."
Kate saw relief in Emmy's face and knew she'd entirely misunderstood.
"Is that all? You don't need to pay it back. I never wanted you to pay it back. It really doesn't matter, Kate. Can't we just forget it? You can pay your own way going forward if it makes you more comfortable."
"Thanks," said Kate flatly. "How big of you?" Emmy looked at her in confusion, like a kicked puppy, and Kate felt a moment of guilt. But this was her life Emmy was playing with. This was the job she'd given up, and the trip she'd taken overseas, and working in a war zone, all under false pretenses. Emmy had blatantly, openly lied to her, because she knew Kate would mind, but she'd gone ahead and done it anyway, and kept on lying. Kate couldn't quite get her head around it, the selfishness of it.
"Did you never stop and think of how this might make me feel?"
Emmy twisted her hands together.
I was hoping you would never find out. And then it would all be all right.
Mademoiselle Marron!
Zaylee came running up, breathless, barreling between them. She stopped in front of Kate, too full of her news to notice the tension in the air.
Deux camions, anglais, and a BA for Mademoiselle Amy.
Zaylee glanced a little nervously at Emmy. She was still wary of Emmy after that incident with the ball back in September. She was Kate's own special assistant, and it was foolish and childish to be grateful she was here now as a sort of shield. Thank you, Zaylee, said Kate, taking the note from her and handing it to Emmy, holding it out from the edge so that their fingers wouldn't touch. Emmy took it, casting a long, searching glance at Kate before dropping her head to the paper.
It's from Captain DeWitt.
Emmy looked up, her whole face lighting.
He sent us 2 loads of duckwalk, proper duckwalk, and 8 Tommies to set it out for us. He says he'll come by later to see that they've put it down properly.
The Tommies, said Zaylee. The Tommies, they ask that you tell them where the walk is to go.
You'd best go then, or we'll have those camions blocking our drive all day. Liza can't drive, so I need to take Dr. Stringfellow out. Some of us need to earn our keep, apparently. Realizing she was being horrible, Kate added stiffly, Please give Captain DeWitt the thanks of the unit.
I will. And Kate?
Emmy paused and turned back, clutching the note like a holy relic.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner, but I'm glad you're here.
Mademoiselle Marron?
Zaylee was tugging at Kate's arm.
Mademoiselle Marron, is there anything else I can do?
No. I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner. That wasn't an apology at all, because Emmy didn't think she needed to apologize. Kate felt sick with anger and grief. It had all worked out as Emmy wanted it to work out, and therefore it didn't matter that she'd done violence to Kate's deepest sensibilities. Maybe she thought Kate didn't have any sensibilities. What was pride to the poor?
Mademoiselle Marron?
Kate looked down at Zaylee with regret. I'm sorry, Zaylee. My mind was elsewhere. J'étais distrait. The girl looked so disappointed that Kate added, I have to drive to Ambleu today. Would you like to ride along with me and the doctors? It was some distraction, listening to Zaylee talk about life before the war, but never her brother. She never talked of her brother, who had been killed by a mine in a field, and Kate was very careful never to ask, and to watch her wonderment as they detoured to Noyon, which Zaylee swore was so big it must be bigger than Paris. They let her help hold the bandages, and she felt very grown up and important indeed, and Kate took a moment from seething to be soothed by the thought that at least she had made someone happy. At least someone saw her as a person and not a project or a pawn. Not that Emmy really saw her as either of those things, Kate knew, not consciously. But she couldn't get past it, that Emmy believed she'd done nothing wrong, nothing other than being found out, that was. Emmy had wanted her here, and so Emmy had arranged it, and never mind how Kate might feel about it. And what if Kate had been miserable in Boston? It was her right to be miserable in Boston. Yes, she was happy here, but not at the cost of her self-respect. She hated that she'd been the recipient of Emmy's largesse. It didn't matter that she hadn't known about it. She ought to have known about it. She ought to have known Emmy well enough to guess. Maybe she had guessed on some level and had chosen not to know, which made it worse because then she was complicit in her own beggaring. They didn't want to pauperize the French villagers, Mrs. Rutherford had insisted. They were to sell, not give. But that was just what Emmy had done to Kate. She'd forced her charity on her. And maybe, just maybe, Kate might have forgiven her if she'd been properly horrified, if she'd broken down and apologized and acknowledged she was wrong. But to stand there and insist it was for the best? It made Kate furious just thinking of it. The rain, the endless rain, dripped down. Even the mud was covered with mud. Nothing was ever dry. The best they could hope for was an acceptable level of dampness. The green twigs they poked into their stoves popped and smoldered. The Canadians explained to them that they were meant to dry the wood on the top half of the stove and then burn it, but there was never enough time, and so their meager fires smoked and never gave off near enough heat to dry their stockings, much less anything else. Tempers ran short, particularly Kate's. It didn't help that Emmy watched her constantly, darting anxious glances at her, as if trying to make sure she was enjoying herself. It soured everything. It made every triumph, every moment of joy, or even mere content, feel like an admission. And she wouldn't, couldn't admit that Emmy had been right, because she wasn't, not about what mattered. When the Canadian foresters invited the unit to their camp for Thanksgiving, Kate would have much preferred to beg off, but she was still, despite it all, assistant director of the unit, and her presence would be expected. If it hadn't been for the Canadians dropping off loads of wood for the unit, they would have frozen long since, or chopped off a few stray limbs trying to chop their own wood. They couldn't afford to offend them. So, grudgingly, Kate put on her cleanest and driest shirtwaist and got back into her despised rubber boots. It was an eerie trip through barren fields marked with barbed wire and desolate forest with the mist rising from the ground. Like something out of a fairy tale, Kate thought, and almost said as much to Emmy before remembering she wasn't speaking to Emmy. She saw Emmy glance at her and looked away, turning to determinedly chat with Miss Ledbetter, who only wanted to tell her all about the history of the forest and the chateau at which the Canadians were quartered. Because it was a castle, a proper castle with a moat around it, not in ruins like Graycor, but an uncannily preserved remnant of an earlier time. Beauty and the Beast, Kate thought. She and Emmy had read Madame le Prince de Beaumont's fairy tales together at Smith. But there were no beasts here, only good, honest Canadians who served them an incongruous supper of lobster and apple pie in a gray-paneled salon trimmed with holly and mistletoe. Kate made an effort to chat cheerfully. They'd gone to such an effort, these Canadians. They'd even made menu cards for each place, decorated with a jaunty American flag. But she felt tired and lonely. All the more lonely in the midst of a crowd, and her hand hurt. She'd scraped it a week ago trying to fix the Ford truck when it had broken down on them outside Canizy, and despite cleaning and wrapping, it still felt as raw as it had that first day, worse even. "Don't forget your dance card," the man next to Kate reminded her when she rose from the table. He flipped the menu over to reveal a dance card. "We're starting with a Virginia reel." "I'm afraid you'll have to roll me through the reel after all that pie," said Kate, and escaped as they began pushing the tables to the sides and sprinkling the old parquet floor with boracic acid for dancing. She couldn't leave until the others did. The truck was waiting to bring them back, but the candles were burning her eyes, the noise too loud. She wondered if she might not be a little feverish. Possibly. Or maybe it was just the exhaustion of being angry all the time, of going and going and going, because if she stopped, she would have to accept that Emmy was never going to understand why she was upset. And if she couldn't, what did it mean for their friendship? Or had they ever really been friends? Kate wove her way across the room, passing Maud, who was holding forth to a group of five foresters. "Our doctors may be all right delivering babies, but as general practitioners, you're better off with a medieval barber surgeon. Liza and I got into their records, and can you believe, for a case of cancer of the stomach, they prescribed soda mints? I ask you." "If that's doctoring, I have a degree too," one of the men said with a grin. Kate paused. She had been there that day. She knew the woman Maud was talking about. Turning, she said, "They gave her soda mints because she was too far gone to do anything else." There was awkward silence and shuffling of feet. Kate felt like an utter heel, but she couldn't have just left it. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. Dr. Stringfellow and Julia were doing their best. "Well, I wouldn't want them to doctor me," said Maud loudly, and turned back to her audience. The conversation resumed, with Kate on the outside of it. A wave of bone-deep fatigue hit her, making her sway on her feet. Usually, Kate enjoyed the rest of the unit. Even Maud's antics were entertaining in their own twisted way. But tonight, she had no energy for any of it. She just wanted somewhere dark and quiet. It was so hot in the gray salon, with all the bodies, people galloping up and down the dance floor, a fire blaring in the great hearth. The foresters had no shortage of wood at their disposal, it seemed. Kate escaped through a lightly gilded door into a room that seemed mercifully unoccupied. As her eyes adjusted to the gloom, she could just make out the shape of furniture and golden lyres molded onto the panels of the wall. Her hand was throbbing terribly. Kate peeled back the bandage, wincing as the scabs stuck to the linen. "What's wrong with your hand?" demanded a voice out of the darkness. A shadow detached itself from one of the settees. "Julia." Kate clutched at the bandage. "What are you doing out here?" "I don't like dancing." Julia hadn't danced at the luncheon for the engineers either, Kate remembered. She'd disappeared as soon as the music started. "Show me that hand." Kate put her hand behind her back. "It's just a scrape." Julia leaned against the carved back of the settee. "It's festering, isn't it?" "I cleaned it. It's something in the soil. Cuts don't heal properly. The soldiers call it Boche Bouton. Don't ask me why. Come to the dispensary tomorrow and I'll dress it for you." "There's no need." "There is if you want to keep your hand." Without changing tone, Julia asked, "Why aren't you and Emmy speaking?" Kate stared at her, startled. "We're speaking." They sometimes exchanged as many as two sentences in a row. Julia let out a short, harsh laugh. "I went to Miss Porter's for 2 years. I know not speaking when I see it." "We've had a disagreement." Julia raised her eyes to the ornate ceiling. "Because no one has ever had one of those before." "Never mind," said Kate, turning to go. But her knees felt like rubber, and she had to grab the edge of the settee to steady herself. "No, wait." Julia wiggled herself up straight, her voice changing, becoming almost serious. "Emmy is the nearest thing I have to family. As opposed to her usual air of sickening cheer, she currently exudes misery. I want to know why." As Julia sat up, Kate caught a strong whiff of spirits. "Did you get into Alice's sherry?" "That rubbish?" Julia raised a silver flask. Even in the gloom, Kate could see that it had a coat of arms on it, old and elaborate. "This is brandy, my child. Want a slug?" "I'll pass," said Kate dryly. No need for Julia to know that she already felt dizzy and that a sip of brandy might put her under entirely. "Suit yourself." Julia waited a moment and then asked, "What happened?" It was too much trouble keeping it to herself, and it was dark, and the thump of feet and tinny din of music echoed from the next room, adding to the general feeling of unreality. Kate lowered herself onto the other end of the settee, folding her hands carefully in her lap. Her fingers felt as though they didn't belong to her. "Emmy's been paying my board without telling me." "Is that all?" Kate's head felt very heavy. She lifted it just enough to glower in Julia's general direction. "What do you mean, is that all? She had no right." Julia shrugged. "She likes to do things for people." Kate shifted against the surprisingly lumpy cushion. "What if people don't want them done? I know you think I'm Emmy's charity case, but—" Julia lowered her flask. "Emmy's what?" "Charity case," said Kate tightly. "Those were your own words. That's what you said. To Nick Peniston, in Newport. You called me Emmy's latest charity." "Oh, yes," said Julia after a long moment. "I'd forgotten that." "I hadn't," said Kate bitterly. It felt very real just then, that long ago moment, coming down the stairs to find those two golden heads together. "Why did you hate me so much? Was it because you thought I was sponging off Emmy? I wasn't, you know. I never took a penny from her. Not then, anyway. Or it was something she had always wondered deep down. Was it because of Nick? Next door, they were playing Blue Danube. The sickeningly romantic strains floated through the room as Julia spluttered on her brandy.
Nick? You thought I was jealous because of Nick?
Why not? Or was I not important enough to be a threat? Just another Bridget, Irish and poor.
Good Lord, Nick, said Julia reminiscently.
He was a decent enough specimen of his kind, as male creatures go. Utterly spineless. Pleasant, but spineless.
No, I didn't hate you because of Nick, said Julia in a detached, cool tone. I hated you because I was jealous of you.
She said it so matter-of-factly, as if it ought to have been blindingly obvious. What on earth could I possibly have that you don't? Julia sat up straighter.
The right to earn your own living. A scholarship, a proper scholarship, free and clear.
That's just because my family didn't have the money to send me. Kate had been so grateful for that scholarship and worked so hard to justify it. Free and clear were never words she would have used to describe it.
Did you think mine had? Demanded Julia. Do you know what I had to do to go to Smith?
Beg. You want to talk about charity cases? You're looking at one. Kate blinked at Julia, trying to make the world stand still again.
But you, your family,
doesn't have two beans to rub together, said Julia, with a certain grim satisfaction. My father lost it all on the stock market in 93, poor sap. Then he killed himself. They put it about that it was a hunting accident, but it wasn't really. He just didn't have the nerve to face my mother. I don't blame him. Well, I do, really. But I can understand why he'd rather face a bullet than my esteemed mater.
But wasn't your mother married to a French count?
It had been mentioned a time or two, or 10.
Oh, yes. This was his. Pretty, isn't it?
Julia waved her flask, the silver glinting in the sparse moonlight. He thought he was getting a rich American. My mother thought she was going to be Marie Antoinette without the whole guillotine bit. Both of them utterly washed up. He was a wonderful old wastrel. He didn't have a sou, but that didn't stop him from buying me rafts of toys and then tearing up the bills, she finished cynically. He had a theory that aristocrats shouldn't have to pay. Unfortunately for him, that was a little too ancien régime for these democratic times. His creditors caught up with him eventually.
I don't think we ever bought anything we couldn't pay for, said Kate wonderingly,
even when they were terribly, terribly poor. Her mother had a horror of credit and of the pawn shop.
We went without when we couldn't afford it.
That, my dear, is because you are poor but honest, said Julia mockingly. But Kate knew, somehow, in this strange half-dream state, that the mockery wasn't for her.
Not a washed-up aristocrat with delusions of grandeur. I refer, as you may have gathered, to my stepfather. My mother hasn't delusions. She's just a venal witch.
Kate thought of her own mother, her work-worn hands turning the pages of a library book as she read to Kate. She must have been so tired. That was before her stepfather, back when her mother was scrubbing houses to keep them fed, but she had always taken the time to read to her.
That seems a bit hard, she said cautiously.
Does it? Julia gave a humorless laugh. She tried to sell me off. They tarred it up by calling it marriage and making it sound honorable, but my debut was really just another sort of auction. I was meant to be the last great hope, snag someone suitably plump in the pocket, and rescue my mother from the indignity of paste jewels. My mother was furious when Aunt Cora agreed to pay my tuition and board at Smith, but she couldn't do anything about it. Darling Auntie Cora holds all the purse strings, so she just had to wait and bide her time. Every moment I was at Smith, I knew I was on borrowed time. You want to know why I hated you? I hated you because you were so free. There you were, off to do whatever you wanted to do. This was not the way Kate remembered it. She felt as though she was being told an entirely different version of her past. Teach French to spoiled society girls? Julia shrugged. Chacun a son goût. Maybe you liked it. Whatever it was, you didn't have someone on at you about how you owed it to her to marry the first wealthy boor who crossed your path. In her usual bored drawl, she added, apparently she gave up her figure for me, and that means I'm meant to keep her in Paris frocks for the rest of her life. Kate said the first thing that came to her head. Wouldn't a strong corset be more to the point? Julia raised her flask to her. Touché. In any event, that summer I was hanging about because I needed to persuade Aunt Cora to front me the money for medical school. Horrible old fraud. Big ideas, big plans, big speeches, but I don't think she'd know a good deed if it bit her. She gives speeches about women's education, but when it comes down to it, it's like squeezing blood from a stone. But a scholarship? Do you think anyone was going to give me a scholarship? You must be joking. The worthy poor, yes. Julia gestured elaborately in Kate's direction. But never Livingston Van Alden's niece. Oh, thanks a lot. I would trade in a heartbeat. With a shock, Kate realized she meant it. I had to beg for the money to go to Smith. The only reason my uncle gave it, and it was he, not Aunt Cora, was because he wanted to annoy my mother. They've always hated each other, my mother and my uncle, since they were children. It's because they're too much alike. And because my uncle actually managed to marry money, and my mother will never forgive him for it. All the feuds were making Kate's head spin. Whatever her own family was, however apart from them she felt, they all liked each other. They might not always understand each other, but they liked each other, and they meant well. You make me feel like my own family is relatively uncomplicated. Everyone's family is complicated, but some of them are nicer than others. My family are vipers, Emmy excepted. But that's probably why she's quite so holy. It had to balance out somehow. I'm a viper. I've had to be. It's bite or be bitten. I always thought you had the world handed to you. That's what everyone thinks. That's what they're meant to think. It's miserable being proud. We're all rotten with it, though. Even Emmy? In her own sweet way. In her case, it takes the form of noble self-abnegation. Emmy's odor of sanctity always makes me feel like a louse, added Julia frankly. But she does mean it, you know. It's not a put-on, like Aunt Cora. I know. That was what was so miserable about it. When Emmy said she meant it for the best, she did. She genuinely felt she was helping Kate. But what if Kate didn't want to be helped? As if she could read what Kate was thinking, Julia said, she can't help herself, you know. She just likes to give things to people. She thinks it will make them like her. I wish she wouldn't. Julia turned her flask this way and that, admiring the sheen. Maybe that's why she likes you, because you're not looking for anything from her. But she'd been given it all the same. All right. How would you feel if you found out someone was paying your way? You dear innocent child. How did you think I got here? My mother disowned me. I'm a medical student. It's all I can do to keep myself in stockings and shirt waists. Kate sat up a little straighter, feeling her head throb with the movement. Is Emmy paying for you too? No, Dr. Stringfellow is. One Smith doctor to another. And you don't mind? I'm here, aren't I? There was silence for a moment as laughter and music filtered from the next room. Kate could barely hear Julia's voice when she spoke. Do you know what I've learned? You take what you can get, and you don't ask too many questions. Scruples are for people who can afford them. When you want something, you do what you have to do. You mean like ask your aunt for money? Asked Kate skeptically. Do you know how I paid for medical school when Aunt Cora said no? I sold my pearls. My mother raised the biggest fit, but there was nothing she could do, other than disown me, that was. best day of my life. I took that money and I paid my tuition and I worked hard, so hard. I lived on bread and milk. I studied harder than any of the boys. But none of them will ever, ever admit that I might be a real doctor. Our doctors may be all right delivering babies. I'm sure they don't all think that, Kate said, because it was the sort of thing one said. When we went to the hospital at Nui, Dr. Blake stroked my arm, said Julia flatly. They all think that way, all of them. To them, I'm just a piece of flesh, because an educated woman must be a whore. Just a whore they don't have to pay for. Kate felt very cold all of a sudden. She'd been so wrapped up in her own misery, she'd forgotten about that day in Amiens, Dr. Stapleton and Auld Lang Syne. Not all of them are Dr. Stapleton, said Kate quietly. There are some decent men out there. Her stepfather, for one. He'd tried so hard with her. It wasn't his fault that she'd never forgiven him for not being her father. It must, she realized, have been as hard for him as for her, having a sullen 8-year-old on his hands. But he'd tried, and he'd never called her anything but daughter. I'll believe it when, how does the line go? When they make men of some other matter than earth. In the voice of one determined to be fair, Julia added, Nick was a good one, as they went. He was sweet on you, you know. Kate's eyes were burning. Her voice came out in a hoarse whisper. He was? I don't know if he'd have had the guts to do anything about it. His mother slept with the social register under her pillow, but he was sweet on you. Julia gazed into the unlit fireplace, her voice sounding very far away. He died, you know, about a month ago. He was shot down. No, I didn't know. Kate was shivering. She couldn't seem to stop shivering. The chills racked her bodies. Sometimes I'd look into the sky and wonder, Kate? Julia swung her feet to the ground, her voice changing. She sounded, suddenly, remarkably sober. Kate felt the back of Julia's hand against her forehead. You're burning up. I thought. Kate's teeth were chattering, and her head felt like there was a vice around it. I thought it was just hot in here. Idiot, said Julia. Come on. I'm looking at that hand, whether you like it or not. Chapter 16. The history of Courcelles is one well known within the annals of chivalry. Across these fields, the Merovingian kings fought their battles. From this castle did the Lord of Courcelles sally forth on crusade with his retinue of knights. And it was here, as legend has it, that the Demoiselle of Courcelles, the first of that name, Lady Melisande, brought the blessed Dame of Orléans, none other than Jeanne d'Arc, and besought her lord to follow the saint into battle for the glory of France. Today, the proud banner of Courcelles no longer flies from that storied castle. It is well known that in these recent hostilities, the present holder of that title, unwilling to bow to the yoke of the German invader, consigned himself and his castle to the flames, bringing to their deaths a number of German officers in the finest tradition of his house. The German repercussions were swift and sure. Nothing now remains of the noble chateau or its accompanying village, but the saddest of ruins. From A Chateau in Picardy, Sketches of France at War, by Miss Ethel Ledbetter. December 1917. Grecourt, France. Madame Lepinasse's hand was limp and cold in Emmy's. Madame Lepinasse? Emmy tried to rise up on her knees to look at the woman's face, but she had been kneeling by the cot for so long that she couldn't feel her feet anymore. Dusk had fallen, leaving the sad room in shadows. Madame? No answer. Outside, through the great hole in the wall left by German explosives, indifferent snowflakes drifted by against a charcoal sky. The little fire, no use against the bitter winter cold, cracked and spluttered.
Madame, wake up. It's me, la dame américaine.
The cat, crouching on top of the pot-bellied stove, gave an unearthly yowl and jumped down to stalk over to her mistress, butting her head against her mistress's limp hand. Mon seul souvenir, Madame Lupinasse had called that cat, the one thing left to her after the Germans had departed. Emmy felt the tears start to her eyes and blinked hard. It was important to stay strong, they had all agreed. It was important that the villagers see them competent and cheerful, but Emmy couldn't help it. There was no one here but the cat, just the cat and the shadows of all the people who weren't anymore, dim daguerreotypes of a husband shot by the Boche, children gone away no one knew where, all gone, 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 and Madame Lupinasse, always so full of life, full of stories told in so thick a Picard dialect that sometimes Emmy could hardly understand her, gone too. Emmy lowered her face to the older woman's cold hand, pressing it to her forehead in apology and shame. She hadn't even known Madame Lupinasse was ill. It had been nearly a month since Emmy had made her appointed rounds in Courcelles. A month. Oh, there had been reasons. First, there had been Miss Luz, who needed to be shown all the animals, and who had been terribly nice about it and tried not to tell Emmy she had done everything all wrong, but had cheerfully gone about fixing everything. The roosters, the useless roosters, had been distributed at a cut-rate price to the people of the villages and had been replaced with actual chickens, who didn't look all that different as far as Emmy could tell, but that was just the problem, wasn't it? She hadn't been able to tell, so she had wasted the unit's funds and cheated her villagers of the fresh eggs they might have been eating all this time. Miss Luz's hens laid beautifully. The villagers had not only eggs, but also three goats, who provided both milk and entertainment. Kate's Zélie had become unofficial goat girl and could usually be seen trotting about running errands, followed closely by Minerva, the smallest of the goats, who seemed to be under the misapprehension that she was actually a dog. Then there had been Liza. It wasn't clear whether it was something wrong with the way the break in her collarbone had been set, as Maud loudly claimed, or if the fault was with Liza for refusing to follow Dr. Stringfellow's orders and stay still, as Julia countered, but Liza's collarbone just wouldn't heal. In the end, there was nothing for it but to send Liza off to Paris for surgery. Maud, of course, had gone with her. So Emmy had volunteered to take over the store. She was half mad with anxiety at that point. It wasn't that Kate wasn't speaking to her. She was speaking to her. She just wasn't saying anything that mattered, and all of Emmy's attempts to broach the topic, to talk it out, only seemed to make matters worse. Everyone else seemed so busy and useful. Anne Dawlish had her carpentry classes, Nell Baldwin was starting a lending library, and Ethel Ledbetter had the older students in hand, which left very little for Emmy to do. Emmy organized games on the lawn once a week, but the children of the Basse-Cour and the neighboring villages didn't need that anymore, not as they had. They were playing on their own now, playing like children again, and it filled Emmy's heart with joy, but also made her feel decidedly out of it. But the store had been an unmitigated disaster. Maud, it seemed, had had a talent for convincing people that what the store had was what they wanted. The wrong sort of sabot? But these sabots were so much better. And she would sell whatever it was and go away with an empty truck, and the people would walk away feeling as though they'd got a bargain. Emmy, on the other hand, would apologize profusely, take copious notes about the right thing, often entirely contradictory, and then give them the offending item as a gift to make up for it. By the end of the first week, the store was deep in arrears and running days behind schedule. They were supposed to have been in Courcelles by then, but Emmy had made it to only 8 villages in 5 days, not the 18 they were scheduled to serve. "We need you on the Christmas party committee," Alice had told her, But what it really meant was that they wanted her away from the store. So Ethel Ledbetter had taken over the store, and Emmy had been sent down to the cellars to sort out Christmas presents for the women and children, a new suit of clothes, candy, and a toy for each child, and a practical present and candy for every adult. It would all be fine, Emmy told herself as she stood in the freezing cellar, digging through boxes, checking her lists and matching up gifts with names, if only they had their trucks again. Then she could do what she was really here to do, social service work with the outlying villages. But the white truck was still in Paris, waiting for a hard rim to be put on, a simple job that was meant to take a week and seemed to be taking a month. The Ford truck had given up the ghost and was in Noyon for parts. Only the jitney still worked, and that sporadically, when coaxed. The sous-préfet at Nell, feeling sorry for them, had loaned them a horse and cart, but Tambour, the horse, had been around since roughly the days of Miss Ledbetter's beloved Merovingians and deeply resented being asked to cart around muscular Americans. It took two of them to move him, one to drive and one to poke him with a stick. He moved at a rate of 2 miles an hour, when he deigned to move at all. Kate, undaunted, had worked out a schedule, allocating use of the jitney and tambour between the store, the doctors, and the social service department, with trips doubled up whenever possible, even though the doctors complained about riding with the store, with the rakes and hose poking them in the posterior, and Miss Ledbetter complained that all those passengers were taking up room needed for goods.
What about Courcel?
Emmy had asked that morning, coming up to Kate after the others had gone, grumbling, on their way.
You don't have Courcel on the schedule.
Yes, I do, said Kate, looking harried. A giant shipment had just arrived from the Red Cross, everything from rice to mattresses to women's winter coats, and needed to be signed for and sorted. It's there for the week after next.
But that's not for ages.
Emmy stared at Kate in dismay, wondering if this was because of their fight, if Kate would have found a way if they hadn't argued. Which was silly, she knew. Kate wouldn't be so petty. At least, she didn't think Kate would be so petty. Then she also hadn't thought Kate would mind so terribly about having her board paid.
I can't conjure trucks out of thin air, Emmy.
Kate had always been slight, but since her bout of fever, she looked like an ivory carving, all thin lines and hollows, burning up from within. As if trying to make up for it, she added,
There's an English Ford for sale in Amiens. I'm going to try to get it for us.
How long will that take?
Kate grimaced. How long does anything take here? I'll do my best.
I know you're doing all you can.
Emmy hurried away before either of them could say anything more, anything they might regret. It had been like that ever since Thanksgiving. There were days when they would seem almost normal again, if somewhat wary of each other, and then Emmy would say something entirely innocuous, and Kate would close up, and they'd be back to the beginning again, with Emmy in the wrong and still not entirely sure why. Kate wasn't the only one being paid for by someone else. Maud was funding Liza. Nell Baldwin's bills were paid by an aunt. It didn't make them any less members of the unit. But when Emmy had tried to point that out to Kate, Kate would only say it wasn't the same. She was so good at all this, Kate. Emmy just wished she could make her see it, how much she was needed, how much she was valued, what a very good thing it was she was here, no matter how she'd got here. Emmy only wished she could be half as useful. On her way to the cellar, Emmy passed Dave, the Red Cross driver. Disastrous Dave, Nell called him, or Dave in the Ditch, for his habit of crashing his truck against their gates, finishing unloading the last of the bags of rice. And that was when she had her grand idea.
Do you think you could give me a lift to Courcel? She asked. I need to do my rounds, and we haven't any cars.
She paused only long enough to stuff a few supplies in her haversack and scribble a note for Kate. Gone to Courcel with Red Cross Dave, back by supper. It was heaven getting away from Graycourt, away from the cold water dripping down the cellar walls, the stench of the animals in their little farm. The sky was an opaque gray that signaled snow, but it wasn't snowing yet, and the clear, crisp air felt glorious against Emmy's cheeks after weeks of rain. The ruined houses and barbed wire had become just part of the landscape now. She was used to them. Army camions rumbled past them on the road, taking a convoy of French soldiers to the front. They waved their caps at her, and Emmy waved back.
Mademoiselle Emmy! Mademoiselle Emmy!
The children had come running out before the truck even stopped in Courcelles, in what had once been the village square before the Germans had got to it. Little hands waved up at her, grabbing at her hands, her skirt. Emmy sank down into the fray, delighted. Miss Ledbetter, much more efficient than Emmy, had made it to Courcelles once a week with the store, but when asked if Pauline had had her baby yet, or if little Léon's cough was better, Miss Ledbetter waxed poetic about the Merovingians and went off on tangents about the Crusades. But here she was herself, with Léon's mittened hand. She'd brought the mittens last month, donated by members of the Chicago Smith Club, in hers, tugging her to see the new school building, which now had benches and five books, five whole books, and wouldn't she like to see them? Why, yes, yes she would. And she needed to see Blondine's missing tooth, proudly displayed with a hideous pulling back of gums, and the new mattresses that had been delivered by the Red Cross man, the one who didn't speak any French. Wait, wait, said Emmy, laughing, as her arm was half tugged off in one direction by a six-year-old, her skirt pulled by a toddler.
I've treats for you all. Let me just get to my haversack.
Monsieur le Commandant had slipped them 700 francs for bêtise, as he called it. Get yourself some scented soap, he'd said, some fresh hair ribbons. So Emmy and Nell had gone to Amiens and indulged in an orgy of shopping. Picture books for the lending library, whatever chocolates could be had, dolls and tops and hobby horses.
This one is for you.
Emmy dug in her haversack and produced a doll, a real doll with a porcelain head for Blondine.
Mind you don't let your little brother get at it.
It was such joy to make her rounds and see everyone, well, not well settled, but better settled. There was canvas stretched over gaps in the masonry, new mattresses donated by the Red Cross and distributed by the unit, little pot-bellied stoves replacing open fires. It was cold, bitter cold, but the children all had warm coats and mittens and mufflers, admittedly a somewhat motley collection, knitted by eager, if not always expert, alumni, but warm, all warm. The milk had been delivered, Emmy was assured. The new storekeeper. She liked her history, eh? They'd made up stories for her and sent her away satisfied. What made up? Contested Blondine's grandmother from her habitual mattress. It was all true. Pauline, whose baby still hadn't come, rolled her eyes at Emmy. Emmy promised Pauline she'd see the doctors visited within the week. Not that there should be any trouble, this was Pauline's sixth, but all the same. Family by family, Emmy made her rounds, checking off names, taking notes, making lists of items still needed. She saved Madame Le Panas for the very last. Although the older woman was a gregarious soul, she lived away from the rest, up the hill, in the ruins of the castle. She'd started as scullery maid and risen to cook in the castle. She'd lived there most of her life, and she'd not be leaving it now, she'd told Emmy, when Emmy had urged her to move down to the valley, to live with her cousins in the village. She had her cat for company, and her memories, and that was enough. It was starting to snow as Emmy trekked up the steep path to the castle, thick, beautiful flakes, like something out of a Hans Christian Andersen story. Her haversack was lighter now, most of her gifts distributed, save for a packet of tea and some precious De Witt's biscuits for Madame Le Panas, who did so love to put the kettle on and have a good gossip, telling stories of the glory days of the castle, of Count Sigismund, who sounded like a lovable old autocrat, and his daughter Aurélie, filching food from the German invaders to feed the village, like a French Robin Hood. Madame Le Panas never spoke of the deformed fingers of her left hand, broken, one by one, when the Germans had questioned her about the whereabouts of Aurélie de Courcelles, who had escaped during the great fire that consumed the castle, or of the husband who had been shot by the Germans in retaliation. It was only the happy stories she told.
Madame?
Emmy was out of breath by the time she reached the summit. This was why no one from the village ever visited. The hill was steep, the path treacherous, the road that had led from village to castle purposefully destroyed by the Germans. The castle was beautiful from below, less so at close range. Even 2 years on, one could smell the soot from the fire that had consumed 1,000 years of history in one go. Madame Le Penance lived in what had once been a guard room, a stone box with narrow windows, which had the benefit of retaining most of its roof, a luxury most of the houses in the village didn't boast. Madame's cat met Emmy at the canvas flap that served as a door, bumping the backs of her legs to push her inside. The stove was cold. The room was freezing. Usually, the stove would be crackling, a rushlight lit, Madame Le Penance sitting in her chair sewing. As her eyes adjusted to the gloom, Emmy finally spotted her on her mattress in the corner of the room, huddled under a blanket.
Madame Le Penance!
Emmy rushed to her side, grasping her cold hand. Madame Le Penance tried to sit up, which was a mistake. She fell back against the pillows, coughing and coughing, a cough that shook her whole frame.
Hush, hush, don't trouble yourself. Here, let me get you some water. I'll make you a cup of tea. You'll feel better after a cup of tea.
Emmy tried to pretend she hadn't heard the dreadful rattle in Madame Le Penance's throat, the rattle that meant pneumonia. How long had she been sick? How long had she been here like this? A day? A week? Had Ethel even known to come up this way? Probably not. It was Emmy's own fault. She ought to have told her. She ought to have been here herself.
Don't worry. I'll have you warm and comfortable in no time.
Murmuring useless nothings, Emmy tucked the blanket around the other woman and poked at the stove, which had gone out entirely. There was an old-fashioned flint sitting next to the stove. Emmy hadn't the faintest idea how to use it. With a surge of relief, Emmy remembered the matches in her haversack. Emmy made a fire as Mrs. Rutherford had taught them, sticks layered, little spills of paper to catch the flames, struck a match, and set it alight. The kettle was bone dry, so was the ewer. There was no water in the house. After checking on her patient, who called her Aurélie, and grabbed at her hand, Emmy extracted herself and found the castle well. The Germans hadn't bothered to poison it. It was too far away from the village. She held a cup of water to Madame Le Penance's lips, got her to drink a few sips, wiped away the spill. By the time she had made the tea, in the broken Limoges teapot Madame Le Penance had salvaged from the wreckage, Madame Le Penance had lapsed into unconsciousness, her chest rising and falling with difficulty, her breath still showing in the air. Emmy stoked the stove, throwing in whatever she could find. The snow fell harder and harder, drifting through the makeshift doorway. Emmy tried to pin the canvas down with a stone, but the wind howled through the edges. On her thin mattress, Madame Le Penance stirred and whimpered, calling for Vincent, for Aurélie.
I'm here, I'm here,
Emmy told her, kneeling by the cot, and Madame Le Penance seemed comforted, at least a little. Emmy stayed by her, frozen in place. She tried to pray, bits and pieces floating through her head. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It was dreadfully shadowy here. He maketh me to lie beside green pastures. There had been green pastures here once. It was horrible to think what had been done, all the waste of it, so much lost, and why? She couldn't even remember why anymore, only that here was a woman who had once had a home, a family, and lived now in a ruin with only a cat and a stranger to hold her hand, to sit by her in the valley of death. Emmy didn't know what time it was or how long she had been there. There was no way to measure time in that little room, with the old wooden shutters barred, the canvas pinned down, the only light the feeble glare of the stove.
Madame Le Penance,
Emmy whispered, but the only sound was the stove, and the hand in hers had gone limp.
Madame, wake up. It's me, la dame américaine.
She wasn't going to wake up, not ever, and Emmy knew it, had known it as soon as she had walked through that door and seen her lying there in that icebox of a room, forgotten, abandoned. Emmy lowered her face to the dead woman's hand and cried hopeless tears as the cat licked the salt from her cheeks.
Why hadn't she thought to ask Dave before? Why hadn't she taken Tambor? Why hadn't she done something? I'm so sorry, she apologized,
but the other woman didn't answer, couldn't answer. She had survived the Germans, had survived torture, and succumbed to winter, to a cough.
If I had been here...
If she had been here, she could have... What would she have done? Tried to shore up Madame Lepanasse's poor little hut to keep the heat in better. Boiled up one of those blasted roosters to make her soup. Done something. Never mind that they lost more people to pneumonia than anything else. They shouldn't. That was what they were there for. It was winter. It was cold. It had been Emmy's responsibility to look in on Madame Lepanasse, to look after her. It had all seemed so reasonable at the time. They hadn't the trucks. Everyone was taking turns. But in the meantime, Madame Lepanasse had been here, alone, sick. Outside, the sky had darkened from silver to charcoal. Dusk. Emmy's limbs felt stiff. She struggled through the snowdrifts down the hill, slipping and sliding, her skirt dragging at her legs, bumping into fallen stones obscured by the snow, too cold and numb to feel the pain, although she knew she'd have a nice set of bruises later. The mayor received her with surprise, a baby on one hip and a toddler holding on to her skirt in the half-destroyed stable she called home. Yes, they would see to the funeral arrangements when they could, but the snow, and it was dark already, and the way up to the castle treacherous.
Can anything be done for her?
If it were summer, the mayor shrugged. In the cold, she would keep. And Madame Lepanasse hadn't been of the village. She had risked her life during the occupation to help smuggle food to the village, but she wasn't one of their own, not really. The mayor had children of her own. Of course she wasn't going up to the castle in the dead of night. And who else would go? Emmy knew the census of Courcelle by heart. The elderly, the infirm, children.
Someone needs to feed her cat, said Emmy helplessly, knowing that no one was going up there after a cat, not now.
It was full dark and still snowing, light in different flurries that didn't care whether they fell on the living or the dead. A broad swath of light suddenly swept the square. Emmy turned and squinted into the glare, which resolved itself into a Ford jitney, which groaned and rumbled its way through the snow, stopping in front of what had once been the town hall. A small, well-wrapped figure swung down from the truck.
There you are, said Kate with relief. We found your note when you didn't come in for supper. What were you thinking, Emmy? Kate.
Emmy clutched her friend's gloved hand.
We need to bury Madame Lepanasse. Madame Lepanasse. She's all alone up in the castle, and she was sick and alone, and I thought with a little warmth and a hot tea, but she's dead, Kate. She's dead, and we can't just leave her there. Do you have a shovel?